Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and I'm in Baltimore, Maryland this morning at public radio station WYPR. Our thanks to them for hosting us today. I'm here because I moderated a forum last night on why so many young Americans are pulling away from faith communities and organized religion. It was a lively discussion with an engaged and pretty opinionated audience, and you're going to hear that next Thursday at 9 a.m. Today, I've asked medical ethicist Jeff Kahn to spend the hour with me talking about the science and ethics of gene editing. You may recognize Jeff's name from his tenure at the University of Minnesota. Here in Baltimore, he directs the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins. And he's with me in the studio. And welcome. It's good to see you again, my friend.
Very good to see
Thanks
you, too.
Doing this.
Thank you.
By the way, Jeff and I will be taking your questions and thoughts via social media today only. So tweet me, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And here's something to think about as we start the conversation. Does the idea of altering a person's genome to cure a disease or even protect future generations from inheriting a disease raise some troubling questions for you? So as we talk about the science and the ethics of gene editing, I want you to think about what it means in your own life, in your own family, and, you know, from a scientific point of view as well, what it means to alter a person's genome to cure a disease or even protect future generations from inheriting that disease. Does it raise troubling questions for you? Do you think scientists should be given more latitude to press ahead? So talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at CarrieMPR. And Jeff, I remember how adept you are at explaining complicated scientific methodology. So I think we ought to begin the conversation with a description of how gene editing works. And I know there are a couple of different ways to approach this. What would you say about it?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to see you as always. Gene editing tools have been a kind of holy grail for molecular biology for a really long time. And people may have heard of experiments around things called gene therapy or gene transfer, so trying to do modification of a living person mm-hmm. by making changes at the genetic level. It just hasn't been very successful, mostly because the tools haven't been precise enough or reliable enough, and they've relied on things like viral vectors, viruses that have been modified in genetic particular ways to allow the insertion of a different genetic stretch into a cell.
So the virus would carry the different genetic
code,
material.
Right,
code
exactly. Material is actually the right way to say it, and inject it into cells in the target area of the body. But it was like a shotgun. Mm-hmm. And so the new tools are really biochemistry that allow much more targeted and much more specific alteration by using these molecular biology tools to actually pre-code the area both for the insertion and for what the change will be made. And so it's an editing. Think of it as literally like a word processor. So going in and cutting and pasting or changing letters to modify the code in very, very precise and particular ways with much more precision, much more reliability, and in a much more targeted way. And so people may have heard of terms like CRISPR-Cas9, which is an acronym, which not important what it stands for because it's just it's for the biochemists and molecular biologists about why it's called that. But it allows, in theory and beginning in practice, for much more precise modification of genetic material. And we should say that that applies not just to humans, which is sort of at one end of a spectrum, but for anything that has DNA. So that's bacteria, that's plants, that's non-human animals, that's humans. And so it's an incredibly powerful tool that's already seeing some important breakthroughs in non-human uses. And the discussion that has been a lot of the focus is sort of what's acceptable in humans and what do we need to know before we start going forward and doing those things in humans.
One of the techniques that I was reading about, not CRISPR, was creating what are known as molecular scissors to essentially snip the DNA and insert the material.
And CRISPR works kind of
CRISPR
that way.
CRISPR does that too?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It is a form of that kind of gene editing where it is a cassette that's created in the laboratory that allows the very targeted location of the cutting. So think of it as scissors. So there's an excising of the gene in a particular place and then a modification inserted.
I want us to take just a minute, Jeff, and marvel at the capability of that, at the science of that. The deeper I read, the more extraordinary it seemed.
Yeah,
I don't want us to talk about this in a casual way.
Oh, no, and it's a huge breakthrough, and I think people believe it's sort of Nobel-worthy science as a discovery. It was maybe more interesting or as interesting as sort of the, you know, marveling at it, as you put it, is that it came from a bacteria. So it existed in nature. It wasn't created by humans. It was discovered by humans, but it was a feature of a bacterial genome that people think had to do with fixing modifications that are the result of an infection or disruption. So it had evolved over time in the bacterial world and is something that we can now take advantage of as humans to control at the genetic level with all the implications that you mentioned in the introduction.
So when you said that this can be used in anything that has DNA, but the big questions are around how it's going to be used for humans, or did some of these big questions start to come up in the plant usage and with animal usage?
Sure. I think so. In all aspects of usage, there have been issues raised, and we can talk about any or all of them. So think, for instance, in the context of insects. So there's talk of genetic modification of mosquitoes, the mosquito that carries malaria or that carries Zika. Those are different species. But one thought is if we could genetically modify mosquitoes such that when they breed, they would create offspring that couldn't infect or couldn't further reproduce. There are different ways to approach this. You could crash a mosquito population that causes disease and potentially do away with diseases like malaria or Zika or chikungunya, these other tropical diseases that are coming to North America as the climate changes. And so that's got interesting public health implications. That's all the on the benefit side. But what happens when you crash a population of a species in an ecology, in an ecological niche? We don't know. And it's a different matter to talk about doing things in the laboratory setting where we can do controlled experiments and see the consequences, implications, and try to understand them in a controlled way. It's quite different when we do something in the laboratory and release it into the environment. There really isn't an example of that in the animal world. Genetic modification of plants has something that bears some resemblance, not without controversy, right? Not without consequences of what happens when you genetically modify crops, say, and the wind carries pollen from a genetically modified crop to a different plant that isn't genetically modified and the implications of that. So I think everything from the animal to the plant world all the way up into the human applications there are implications and there are discussion. I mean, there are even conversations about biosecurity and potential use of these tools for things like bioweapons creation and what needs to be done on an international treaty scale to control the use of these tools and make sure they're not put to nefarious use.
I have some questions later about the biosecurity issue, but I don't want to miss where the ethical conundrums come in. Is it about unintended consequences? We just don't know what the ripple effect of intervening in with this kind of procedure would be. Or is it more about should we, even if we can, should we do this? Put the unintended consequences aside. So where's the intersection of the real ethicist questions here?
I think yes and yes to the way you asked the question. So we can look at the way the folks in the policy and ethics and medical worlds have treated gene transfer experiments, gene therapy experiments. So I mentioned earlier using viral vectors to try to make change at the genetic level for people who were sick and how to control that and what the concerns about that were. So that's if somebody shows up and has a disease like muscular dystrophy, for which there are very few good therapies, and it's a genetic disease. It's inherited. The gene is known. So the target is understood. And so you'd want to get change introduced into the cells in the muscle, genetic change into the cells in the muscle, so that they would produce the protein that they lack and cure that disease. So what are the concerns about doing experiments like that on humans? One is we don't know what the unintended consequences might be. So that's one answer to your question. The second has always been around safety. Okay, so unintended consequences of sort of, you know, well, what about the things we don't understand? But also, we don't want to do things that will be toxic to people, right, or kill them, right? So it's a sort of safety to the individual. And then the third, which is really where it gets interesting, is we don't want to make changes at the genetic level that will be heritable, right? So we call that germline modification. Mm-hmm. And so when you're using this shotgun approach that I mentioned before of viruses, there always was a concern that those changes might actually cross the germline and get into the cells in the testes if it's a male, or the ovary and eggs of a woman. So how do you prevent that from happening? And how do you know whether it's happened or not? With the shotgun approach, that was always something that people worried about. And there was a bright line, and there still is a bright line in policy, of making sure that there are no modifications introduced in individuals that are heritable, so that it can be passed on to future generations. Because once that happens, you can't get it back, right? It's a change that goes only one direction. At least that was the argument. So those are sort of two kinds of changes, safety and unintended consequences on one hand, germline modification on the other. And then the third is, are we fooling around in areas where we ought not, just because of what it means to modify people at the fundamental level of our genes, right? And is it, to coin a phrase, playing God in a way that is unacceptable? So those are the sort of three big ethical and policy areas. So the new tools just bring them in a way into more clear, right, focus.
Right.
Because now we can do things that we were, you know, said, well, it would be nice to do these things, but we didn't have the tools to do them. Well, now we can. And among the things that actually are much more plausible than they were in the past was doing genetic modification of people, not only to cure them, but to actually prevent them from passing on whatever is causing them to be sick, from afflicting their offspring. So actually intended modification of the germline. We're actually talking about that now in a way that we never thought was acceptable before because it was too risky.
We've got some good ideas and questions coming up just around that on Twitter, too.
Great.
So if you've just tuned in, I'm hosting the show this morning from WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland. I was here to do a discussion last night about faith and millennials, and you'll hear that next Thursday. But since I was here, I asked Jeff Kahn if he'd come in and talk to me about medical ethics and gene editing today. You probably remember him from the University of Minnesota, but he is now doing his medical ethicist work at Johns Hopkins, where he directs the Institute of Bioethics. And today, as we talk about gene editing, you've heard the description of the science behind it. You've heard our discussion a bit here on the ethics of it. I want to know how this feels to you. Does the idea of altering a person's genome to cure a disease, or even, as we were talking about, protect future generations from inheriting a disease, does it raise some troubling questions to you? Maybe within your family, there is an inherited disease, and this really hits home with you. If doctors or if scientists could come in and alter the genome to assure that that gene wouldn't be passed down through your family, that sounds like something exciting for your family. And then, of course, you open your mind to the unintended consequences of that. We're taking your ideas and your questions here on social media today via Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. And Jeff, here's a listener who says, having struggled through early onset Alzheimer's with a family member, I would pursue nearly any means not to subject my children or grandchildren to that degeneration. That is, I think, one of the perfect questions that meets ethics in a terrible disease.
Right. And the question is whether the right approach at that, if there were a genetic modification that could be introduced to prevent somebody from falling ill from early onset Alzheimer's, is whether to wait until that person is born and then do this intervention, or make the intervention on the person who knows that they have the risk of passing it on into future generations. So there are sort of two choices. Somatic intervention, so that's intervention into the individual in a way that will not allow them to pass on that modification into their future offspring.
So basically it begins and ends with you.
Perfect. Okay. Exactly right. Versus germline modification, which prevents it from being passed on through your line forever. Right, it doesn't take it out of the gene pool, but it reduces your contribution to the gene pool. And so up until now, we have said there's just a bright line we won't cross. We won't do germline modification because we just don't understand enough about how to modify genes in a way that makes us feel confident that we won't do something unintended that we can't undo. Right, so that's really the problem. It's not just for your offspring, it's for their offspring and their offspring's offspring, and on you go forever, right? And so the concern was we are – that's hubris on the part of humans to think that we know enough to say, sure, let's get rid of Alzheimer's as a risk forever. That's a great thing. Well, we don't understand enough about the gene-environment interaction, for instance, and to use an example that people are usually familiar with, carrying the sickle cell trait – right, not the disease, but the trait is protective against malaria infection. Now, that isn't as relevant in 2017 and 18 as it was, you know, obviously a long time ago living in Africa, but it has persisted.
It also depends on where you live.
Exactly,
too.
And it's persisted in the human population. There are other genes that seem to cause illness. They do cause illness that also persist in the human population, and it isn't clear why that is. We don't seem to understand enough about that. Cystic fibrosis would be an example. It's not as prevalent. It's 1 in 10,000. That's a lot in genetic terms. So there's some thought that there's some protective aspect of not being really sick with cystic fibrosis, but of having that genetic modification at some low level. It's not clear what that is, but there's some reason that it continues in the human population. So we have to be careful is sort of the concern. And so the fallback, I guess, or the way to sort of get the benefit of the interventions that we're thinking about without crossing the line and into these concerns is to say we will just take on the somatic approaches. And that's really been the focus of all the discussion so far by all the communities that are involved with this. Let's focus on somatic modification.
Isn't it the case, though, Jeff, that was it CRISPR was developed by Jennifer Doudna?
Doudna, yeah.
In collaboration with a geneticist in Sweden.
It's actually a big controversy
in the
community about who discovered it. And there's, in fact, a patent fight between Jennifer's group. It's her and a woman named Emmanuel Charpentier, Belgian, I think, and a group at MIT Harvard, who both claim to have been the first. And there's been an ongoing patent fight. And the first round, believe it or not, was won by the Harvard-MIT group with a little bit of a side victory by the Jennifer Doudna UC Berkeley group.
You can see why the stakes are so high.
And the stakes are incredibly high.
But here was my question about this. As I read it, Professor Doudna advocated for a moratorium on using CRISPR to create these inherited changes. So that's interesting. The capability, she can see the potential for the capability, and then immediately she suggests a moratorium. To be politically correct, to be ethically correct, or why?
So the policy environment in this area is really interesting, and we could spend an entire hour talking just about that. So the moratorium that you're mentioning was the product of a small group that got together early on after the discovery of CRISPR-Cas9. There have been subsequent larger collections of people, meetings, international summits, and a National Academy of Sciences and International Science Academy's Consensus Committee, which I was a member of, full disclosure, that wrote a report that was issued in February of 2017 that all made recommendations about how far to go. And the NAS International Consensus Committee actually didn't call for a moratorium. It actually said, we need to know more, and these are the kinds of things that would actually warrant thinking about doing germline modification, with a list of 10, very long list, actually, of 10 criteria that would need to be met. So very, very high bar, but not saying there should be a moratorium forevermore. It's an interesting discussion.
So your group said, when we know this, then we can decide whether to proceed with this technology. Isn't that in effect for now, a moratorium on it?
Well, so that's an interesting question too. So moratorium, to most people, thinks it's a that means prohibition, and that's a sort of a language thing. So you're right, a pause at least, or a hold. A moratorium is more like a hold. You're right, but moratoria tend never to be released, at least in this world, science policy world. So it's a set of criteria that would need to be met, which include when we know more, as you put it, but also for particular conditions for which there are no alternatives for either somatic or other kind of therapy. So the one example would be when you have two parents who are at know that they're at risk of passing on the Huntington's disease. So there's no way for that couple to have a genetically related offspring that won't carry the Huntington's disease gene. That means they will be affected. And so you can't. There is no possible way for that couple to have a genetically related offspring. So that raises another interesting question. What is there a right in the United States or any country in the world for people to have genetically related offspring? And if so, why? Based on what? And do we need to go to the extent of this very high-tech science with all of the unknowns and the risks that we're discussing to allow someone to do that? And what would we need to know before that was something that would be acceptable? It raises really interesting questions about things like consent, because the individual that would need to give consent hasn't been created yet, right? So how do you even think about consent in those contexts?
Kristen asks on Twitter, so let's say in the future gene modification becomes a thing. What's to keep it from becoming a privilege for rich people, since they will be most likely to access this therapy more than poor populations? She's saying, not sure where this lands, but just a thought. Yeah, really good thought.
That's a great thought. And she's just exactly right. And that is, of course, the trajectory of many new technologies that early on become the privilege of those who are able to afford them. One argument is that as they are adopted and available and paid for by those who can afford them in the highly developed world and even the richer people in those highly developed parts of the world, they become more affordable. So it's sort of an argument for trickle-down technology, there's some argument actually for that. You sort of can't get to wider availability without going through this stepwise process. And so it's important that things be introduced, you know. Smartphones, I guess, is an example of that outside of the biomedical realm, where the first smartphones were incredibly expensive and some still are incredibly expensive, but they're also very affordable versions of smartphones that are now widely available across, you know, most of the world. And we wouldn't have that technology were it not for the very early, very expensive introduction.
Another observation here from Twitter on that and what you're just saying. Love your conversation on ethics and gene editing. Not uncomfortable with the ethics of it, except in possibility of Gattaca scenario. Richest people feel no responsibility toward the rest of us not able to afford another way to let them die from a town hall, a political town hall, she's referencing a few years ago. Any other?
Well, you're right. And the truth is there's, widening inequality in the world in all sorts of areas. And so one thing that needs to be addressed is this area. How do we make sure that the benefits of these technologies are made widely available to across the global north and south? So more developed, less developed parts of the world, even within the developed parts of the world, those who are more advantaged versus those that are less advantaged. We, of course, don't want a future that is Gattaca-like, where the only people who get advantage in a society are those who are genetically modified, prior to their being brought into existence, right? That's the story of Gattaca, where if you're created the regular way, you're immediately disadvantaged and aren't eligible for all sorts of things. In that story, it was about flying into space. And so, of course, we don't want that future. And we need to make sure as we work towards adoption of these technologies that we don't fall prey to those futures.
What about the idea, even Jeff, as we were talking about holding off on affecting the germline, just doing this individually to cure a disease or affect a condition, the taking into consideration the idea that you are perhaps fundamentally altering the essence of who that person is. And you know, and I'm saying even with their permission, yes, cure this disease. But how much, how, what's the discussion around, and you will be different on the other side of that?
Yeah. And the question is, what kinds of difference matter in terms of making you who you are? Is sort of, you know, are there changes at the genetic level that will actually alter an individual's identity?
Right.
That would be the sort of philosophical way to ask the question. And we need to wrestle with that. So there's, you know, if we were to say somebody with muscular dystrophy is a different person after they've been treated for that than they were before, I'm not sure that's right. They certainly have a different life. But things that are that affect your cognitive ability, right? So things like Huntington's disease or Alzheimer's, as we were talking earlier, or some of the other neurological, Lesch-Nyhan syndrome, so some of the inborn errors of metabolism that cause horrible neurological degeneration. It's hard to argue that that person wouldn't be different, right? Were they treated versus not treated? And so the question is both what changes matter and whether the change is something that we ought or ought not to take on.
And I'm thinking about making that choice as the person who says, if it will cure this or it will allow me to live a life like this, I'll basically do anything without being able to possess the knowledge of what it will be like on the other side.
Well, and to be really provocative, there's a lot of discussion about things like Down syndrome, where we clearly very well understood what causes Down syndrome and whether somebody should intervene such that you've taken away the trisomy and made it a quote-unquote normal genome. Now, that person would be quite different, arguably, and whether that difference is something that ought to be selected, right? And what that says for people who have not been, quote-unquote, treated for Down syndrome is a really important and provocative social question.
As in, you have a condition that society has decided needs to be fixed.
Correct.
Since we can.
And there's discussion about Down syndrome and prenatal testing and selective termination. Which is a similar discussion. So if there were a genetic intervention, so the individual who was born or maybe in vitro or in utero, there could be a genetic modification. How would that change the discussion about things like Down syndrome and disability and, as you say, you know, whether people should or shouldn't exist with particular conditions? So a very interesting moment in our social discussion about genetics, genome interventions, what it means and for whom and how we do it.
Here's a tweet that I think goes to just what we were talking about. A listener says, I'm watching the field of gene therapy very closely since learning a family member has a rare genetic pattern and multiple genetic patterns. I'm cautious that gene editing might alter more of who she is beyond curing her. Yeah, right too. We were talking about. If you've tuned in this hour, just gotten with us, I'm in Baltimore, Maryland today at WYPR. Jeff Kahn is here. You remember him as a medical ethicist from the University of Minnesota. He now runs the Berman Institute of Bioethics here at Johns Hopkins. And he's with me in the studio to talk about the science and the ethical implications of gene editing. Great questions and thoughts coming in via Twitter. And that's how we're doing it today, just social media. Reach me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. The one thing we haven't, a couple things we haven't covered yet, Jeff, I was reading about a biologist at a hospital in Oregon who was working on using gene editing in an embryo to prevent a heart condition that causes sudden death. What are some of this comes back to what you said, you can't get the consent of the embryo for something like that. What are some of the ethical questions that come up around that?
That's a really interesting and important example. So that's the case at Oregon Health and Science University, Metalipov and his group, who, as you say, they wrote a paper that claims, and there's a bit of uncertainty in the scientific community about what their outcomes actually show, just as a matter of FYI, that they were able to modify at the in vitro embryo level the genome of a developing embryo that removed, as you said, a known genetic mutation for cardiac disease risk. So it raises a lot of interesting questions. One, it was an important paper because it seemed to show very precise and controllable use of these new gene editing tools. So it was kind of proof of concept very early on in the course of the basic science in the use of these tools. So that was actually really surprising and a big important paper for that reason. Although the scientific community turns out not to be convinced that they did what they said they did and for the reasons that they said they did it.
Okay.
So the jury's a bit out, I guess I would say. The other thing that it shows is that there is an ability to modify at the germline level. So realize if you do genetic modification of an embryo in a petri dish, you've modified every cell in that developing embryo in a way that were in it implanted into a woman's body and grew into a fetus and a born baby, all of those cells would be modified in a way that they would be passed on to the future offspring of that person. Right. So that's a germline modification. So they immediately showed that they could, in a human embryo, do the thing that we have been so concerned about for so long. Now, there was never any intention and implication of taking that embryo and implanting it, but it showed that it worked, at least they claim, in a human in vitro embryo. And so we immediately went to the most controversial application without, you know, pass and go, collecting $200 or whatever you would say. And that raised a lot of concern in the scientific community, both because it seemed to jump over a lot of steps of what people thought would be the normal course, which is, well, it will go fits and starts and we won't know how it works for a long time and, you know, it won't be as controllable until we learn more. But it seemed immediately to work in the way that people had hoped. And it also showed a sort of recipe for how to do this in human embryos in a way that you sort of think, well, you know, you may not make the cake, you know, by looking at the picture of it, but if someone gives you the recipe to all the steps, then you too could do this. And it turns out among the things that are a feature of CRISPR-Cas9 and the other gene editing tools is they're much easier to use than some of the early recombinant DNA tools from the 1970s and that were in use until most recently. And so laboratories around the world could take the recipe that the group in Oregon published and do the same thing in human embryos in contexts where there were fewer controls. So that's the sort of long way to say they kind of opened the Pandora's box rapidly and almost fully in a way that concerned people in the policy and ethics community.
Whenever you and I talk about this, I at some point in the discussion, and now's this point in this one, we come back to, of course there's a tension between scientific advances and where the ethical discussion is around that. Are you at ease at the moment with that tension? Is the push and pull on either side, we can do this, should we, in the right balance in your view, or are we off?
I think it's in a good place in that there is a lot of discussion with people who are in a position to help shape policy and make policy. So it isn't as if we're playing catch up in the way that we sometimes have in the past. So it feels like we are talking about the ethics and policy alongside the scientific advancement, which is a good thing and an appropriate thing.
Uh-huh.
I tell you, what does give me some pause is that the ease with which these tools can be used and the much greater international nature of science today than even 30 or 40 years ago, that it's not clear how controls get instituted or even agreed upon across countries, right, and across international boundaries. So people publish in the same journals, whether they work in Oregon in the United States or in Shanghai in China or, you know, fill in the blank. I don't mean to pick on those two places. And so what if anything, can we do to create some rules of the road, as it were?
And how internationally, you're
internationally
saying.
Thank you, yes. And what can be done to enforce them is even a more important question. So among the work that I'm involved in, actually some international discussion around what the norms and rules of the road ought to be, but a big and important and unclear next step is, okay, this group, whatever it is, can agree, but how do we get that turned into policy that has any teeth? And there aren't good examples for how to do that.
Interesting question here from Twitter. A listener says, does Jeff think conscience can be edited. Is it feasible to edit a gene that would remove sympathy or compassion within a human? Thinking of super soldiers, which at one point may have been laughable, but not with CRISPR.
Yeah. Well, maybe someday is my sort of direct answer to that question. But it's an interesting and important thing to consider. So just to play this out a little bit, among the people who have been interested in the implications and applications of these tools are the U.S. Department of State. Why? Well, you say, well, what are they, you know, what stake do they have in treating and curing Alzheimer's? Well, it isn't about that. It's about the foreign policy and international policy implications of things like scientific competitiveness and uses in agriculture and domesticated animals, and whether a country, a rogue country, might say, we want to create super soldiers.
This brings us back to the biosecurity discussion.
And so exactly the point that the tweeter raises is on the minds of people who are trying to be foresightful about, you know, what should we be thinking about. It's a harder question about what to do, because as I said, these are not sort of super secret, difficult to obtain, hard to use tools. They're not that at all. I mean, you need more than your basement chemistry set, but anybody who's, you know, semi-sophisticated and working in laboratories pretty much anywhere in the world could use these tools in all sorts of ways. And among the most leading-edge science that's being done is actually coming out of the People's Republic of China, where the commitments around use of embryos, human embryos, for instance, are just different than they are in the United States and some European countries. So it's not to say that there aren't rules. It's just different commitments about what the rules should be.
Ryan says, how do we ensure that this modification technology doesn't fall into the wrong hands? What could Hitler, for example, have done with this technology? And then he adds, can we change our skin color? Boy, that could be a whole show in and of itself.
Right.
Oh, that'd be fascinating.
The answer to the first question is people are trying to figure out maybe not how to prevent it from falling into the wrong hands, but to prevent things from being done that are outside the bounds of what these norms might be. But there are already examples of people using related techniques and technologies to do very kind of leading edge, never before done reproductive technologies outside of the controls of a country like the United States or Western Europe. So there always will be rogues, and the question is how to control them to the extent that we can. I think it's very, very difficult and will be increasingly difficult as these technologies become more refined.
One of the things you mentioned is not just the idea of curing, but enhancing, and that this is a technique that could be used to do that. And you actually, I think, used the example of muscular dystrophy.
Yes. So this has been a longstanding, concern and a bright line really for gene therapy, where it's acceptable to do genetic modification for the purpose of curing and maybe preventing disease. We talk about prevention and how that plays in if you like, but not to enhance. Now, the line between treating, curing, preventing disease and enhancement it turns out to be really difficult to define and really unclear. But the example that we might use is to say, well, if there were a gene modification technique to treat muscular dystrophy and alter the proteins in the cells of a boy with muscular dystrophy so that they would make the protein and the muscles would be normal, mm-hmm. Someone could say, wow, couldn't you do the same genetic modification on an otherwise normal person and give them more muscle? The answer is yes. So we were saying off the air, I could become a linebacker, not really, but I could become more muscular in a way that might make me, you know, 240 pounds and more muscular than my 170 pounds and whatever I am, right? And whether it makes me into I'm not going to be a linebacker, but you get the point. So somebody early in their life might say, if this is the advantage that I need to become a professional athlete, and it's not just, you know, think about the international cycling community and the Tour de France and all of the
right,
controversy around Lance Armstrong and other people doping. So genetic doping is a real concern. And so using the same techniques for enhancement in ways big, small, detectable, not so much, are an absolute concern. And these techniques will provide the tools to do that in a way that will be much more difficult to restrict and control.
If you've just gotten into the conversation here and you've missed most of it, I want to let you know that's on the podcast. Some really interesting questions have come up here. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland today at WYPR, and Jeff Kahn is with me in the studio here, formerly of the University of Minnesota, now of Johns Hopkins. And we're having a discussion about the science and the ethical implications of gene editing. And you've raised some fantastic, I think, provocative questions, too, on Twitter. So I appreciate that. We've got a few minutes left if you're thinking about this and you've got maybe a disease within your family. I mean, in some ways, this conversation really hits home for you. I'd like to hear about that on Twitter and how you wrestle with the ethical implications of it. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Here's a listener who I think speaks to that. Jeff, Rachel says, I had brain surgery to remove a tumor. Would you forego the surgery to not alter yourself? I feel the same about many diseases. Of course, this presupposes informed consent. Good pushback on where our discussion went.
Absolutely. And so one question is, what constitutes altering the self, right? So that's a philosopher's question and a really interesting one, but one that we kind of need to wrestle with more before we sort of know when we've crossed a line and then tell people, you know, you might be a different person than the one that you started out being. People talk that way even about things like bone marrow transplant, where they actually feel like they're quite different and they have a different immune system, right? The donor's right. immune system has become theirs. And so people talk this way in other areas of intervention and therapy. It's an interesting question when the intervention might be at the embryonic level and whether that mattered more or less, right? Doing a genetic modification that may be identity changing, and whether that's a treatment of a disease or rather that's just making one person into another in a way that's quite different and you couldn't have consent for, obviously, right? You're foregoing one person to create another.
Mm-hmm.
And how to think about that and who needs to make that decision. Now, one thing to say is we rely on parents to make decisions about their reproductive futures in all other areas, and some of them higher tech than others. And so isn't this just like another version of IVF and other of the more leading edge reproductive technologies? And so why should we be treating this any differently than we do those where the parents or the prospective parents are the ones who get to decide? And that's, I think, an important question for us to try to wrestle with. But these weren't issues that were as pressing until these techniques became available.
You know, I'm going back for a minute here to what you said about what happened with Oregon showed that this was more accessible to...
More possible.
More possible, I guess. You know, who's to say... And then I remember you mentioning a few minutes ago that China may have different rules on this. Who's to say that as China assesses the incentives and the science of it, that they're coming up with the wrong answer on me? You know what I'm saying?
I do. And I think you're absolutely right. And I should have been even more clear. The U.S. FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in our country, has a prohibition on receiving any application for licensure of a clinical trial, let alone a product that will do any kind of modification that leads to genetic change of the individual at the heritable level or relies on a heritable genetic change for whatever that product might be. So there's a prohibition in this country for doing that in a human context. Cannot be done. And that was inserted in the budget bill in the last year of the Obama administration. So that's not a part of the Trump administration's policy. That actually came from Congress in late 2015. So as a policy matter, are in a different place than places like China. And so one of the questions is, are we willing to cede the competitive, right, sort of pinnacle here of science achievement to other countries? And it isn't just China that would fall into that category. The UK actually has much more permissive policies, but with much more controls than we do. So that's a third example. So China is sort of more open and will permit things to go forward in a way that aren't in ways that are not quite as controlled as in the UK, which has very tight control, but will permit things going forward in a very narrow and controlled way. And we just have a flat prohibition in this country. So
yeah,
three different examples.
I guess I don't want us to think, I think we're accustomed to thinking of China as, you know, what, the evil empire, or our competitors in nefarious ways. And who's to say they don't have it right when it comes to the ethical consideration of this?
Right. And I should say that their decision-making is based on a different cultural belief about the status of a human embryo outside of the body.
Right?
So a human embryo in a petri dish in China is a clump of cells in a way that in our country we treat that as a potential human person, and increasingly work to, as a matter of some state law, in fact, protect that potential human person in a way that would never happen in policy in other parts of the world, and certainly not in China.
The other thing I'm curious about is you mentioning this language getting into a budget bill during the Obama administration is how well equipped you think Congress, our political leaders, are to have the most insightful debates about this science. I see your face. Not a lot of confidence.
You're reading my. It's the thing about the
That's
radio.
The beauty we're not of being supposed, in the same studio,
yeah, we're not
right
supposed
here.
To be. We're not in a visual mode here. But I was almost going to say that's a rhetorical question, but you sort of outed me in the way you just read my facial expression. But it's true. It's a matter of a lot of very technical policy that's nuanced, and our system isn't really set up to deal with this level of nuance and technical sophistication. That said, I gave testimony right before the end of the year before the Senate Help Committee, so that's Health, Education, Labor, and Pension, and very careful, smart, actually bipartisan questions and concerns, a lot focusing on what has to happen to make sure that we realize the benefits of the advance of this science without having, not falling prey to the unethical, potential uses, and a lot of concern about competitiveness of American science. So I don't know that they were landing in exactly the right place, but they certainly were talking about this in ways that gave me some, what heartened me a bit along about the policy debate. Now, whether, it rises to the level of they're doing much about it, given all else that's going on in Washington, is a different matter.
I have a couple minutes here. I just want to ask you, in the perfect scenario, How would information be flowing to Congress so that they were making the most informed decision? I'm asking whether there would be an overriding organization that you'd be a part of that says, we are going to make serious recommendations and this shall get into the legislation,
Yeah. Well, it part of it is a feature of our civics where it's Congress, but it's also the executive branch agencies.
Uh-huh.
And we do have actually a very well-working FDA policy process. The problem is the budget bill in 2015 put a stop on this area of science going forward in a human context. That should be removed.
Okay.
And I've said that. It's not a secret that I've said that. I mean, a lot of people have said that. So putting roadblocks like that in place actually turns out to be a bad idea. Prohibitions lead to rogues going offshore to do things in ways that are totally out of our control. That's bad policy. That doesn't serve the purposes of anybody. And so we need to have a careful, controlled licensing and oversight process, which we do. It's called the FDA. And so let them do their job is what I would say, and don't insert things in budget bills that are a kind of piecemeal that put roadblocks in ways that prevent the good science from going forward in ways that can benefit Americans.
Jeff, really good to see you again. Thanks. Thanks for doing this.
Really great to see you too.
And I'm really grateful to WYPR here in Baltimore, Maryland for hosting us. Thanks to you.